Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Today on the show, Press 53 publishers celebrate their 100th title. Rinalda House pays tribute to American icon Rosemary Bearden. And the Southeastern Center for Contemporary Art visits the streets of New Delhi. In terms of music, our good friend Peter Karoff is on vacation today, but we do happen to have another celebrity in our midst, singer-songwriter extraordinaire Mr. Ben Taylor and his band. Join me live in Studio A next on Triad Arts Weekend. Press 53 is an award-winning, 10 so far this year alone, independent publisher of poetry and short story collections based in Winston-Salem. It opened its doors in October of 2005, and next week, it celebrates publishing its 100th title. It's a collection of short stories titled In a World of Small Truths by Ray Morrison. Kevin Morgan Watson is the founding editor of Press 53, and he's collaborated with writers setting off on their first book to Pulitzer Prize winners. He's not big on market trends and publishes writing that hits him at a gut level, like the first work in Ray's new book. The powerful short story is titled Laid to Rest. Ray and Kevin drop by to talk about it. Laid to Rest, the opening scene and the description of this animal, it's real powerful. Talk about your dual life, I mean, as writer and a veterinarian.
People ask me all the time when they learn that I have a dual life, particularly my veterinary clients are amazed that I'm a fiction writer as well. My veterinary side of my Jekyll and Hyde personality helps me do is bring some of that reality to descriptions. But there's a balance. I had to be careful not to be so graphic that it upsets readers.
In this short story, and I want to get the publisher's take on the architecture of stories and what you're looking for when you're selecting them. But I'm impressed when I see lots of levels within a short story. In this case, such familiar themes that it's just a visceral connection with the bully in the class. And I just had my 30th high school reunion last month and was almost afraid to even consider going back because if I had bumped into that bully, I don't know what I would have done. And it's been 30 years since I saw that guy. You tap into that, but then you bring in this almost a supernatural element with this young, deformed man. Could you talk about that from the creation standpoint when you're just setting pen to paper for the first time, the architecture of this piece and what you'd hope to achieve with it?
Well, I'll tell you the honest truth is with most short stories that I write, and I think I can speak for a lot of short story writers going through the same thing, is my first and foremost goal is to entertain. I want my story to be interesting, and I'm not sitting down to create a message. I'm sitting down to entertain, and I have to be entertained, and if I'm not, then the reader's not going to be entertained. And particularly with a story like Laid to Rest, I had no idea that that was going to happen in the story when I began the story. I just had an image in my head of a couple of neighbors in the country and one fella getting up one morning to go feed his dog and finding his dog dead and dead in an obvious way that was not an accident. And that's really all I had when I started that story. I knew I wanted a conflict with the neighbor because all good fiction has conflict, right? And I just started describing. And I set him out on that journey to go confront his neighbor about the dog because he was dead certain in his head. I knew that much, that his neighbor was the one who killed the dog. The whole thing, I don't want to spoil it for everybody, but the whole surprise in that story with the child came about. That story probably took me about 3 to 4 weeks to write, and I was probably a good 2.5 weeks into that story before that idea came to me.
Even without the surprise, it's so powerful. I think just the nerves that he feels going to confront this neighbor alone. Was it a foggy in the morning time? It's kind of, yeah. I'm picturing fog. Maybe it wasn't even there, but with the shotgun, and there he is at the doorstep to greet him. That this big burly guy. But then there is this twist. And often in short stories, I find that there's something unexpected that occurs when that happens. In this case, 2 weeks in, 2.5 weeks in, is that oh, that's what I've this story's I've been waiting for. I knew it would come, or is mm-hmm. it just this is a really rare event? How do you when that light bulb goes off? What's it feel like? What do you?
Oh, it's a great feeling. It's a great feeling because I knew I hit on what this story needed, and you know that doesn't always happen, but yeah. when it does, it's for a writer. It's the magic moment. That's what you want, and then once I hit on that, I just raced to the end of that story.
Yeah. Mm.
You know, some novelists tend to outline, because it's such a huge work. It's a long journey. It's 300-400 pages. But short story writers, I found what's exciting about that is there's a real energy at work there that they might start the story with a question, simple question. What if this happened? Or it might be a line, first line that might spark some interest. Well, why is that? And they don't know where they're going. And so as they write and they progress and they trust that if they put the energy into the story, that it will deliver. And that's what I love about short stories. I've often found that a story that takes you 15 minutes to read will stay with you for a lifetime. And rarely do these 15-minute stories take 15 minutes to write. That's that doesn't happen. They can take weeks, sometimes years, to let that energy come to fruition and to trust it, to learn to trust it. You know, you can't force these things. So, and I think Ray's learned to trust that and just be patient. You know, there's a lot of patience involved in not wanting to, I want this ending, and it's not what it's about. It's not your story anymore. It becomes, you're the medium. You know, there's a lot of things about Southern writing, and I don't think you have to be from the South to be a Southern writer. I know a lot of Southerners who aren't Southern writers, and a lot of Northerners who are. Hmm. And I think it's a matter of how you approach the story and how you respect the language and your word choices. I mean, the South is noted for its colorful use of language. Metaphor and simile figure heavily into it, which I think is why poetry is on an upswing as well.
Do you ever reflect on, how many lives you're impacting with this? I mean, this is 100 publications.
Every day, you know, when I, there are days when I shake my head and think, what am I doing? I am running in circles here while I'm sitting down. But you can't just get up and walk away from it because you've got a lot of people counting on you. I remember Joseph Anderson, who I published his memoir, one of the first books I signed to the press. And about a year into the press, he said, well, man, you're too important to leave now. You can't turn your back on this. You're stuck. But it's a great place to be stuck, you know, doing what you love and finding what you think is are interesting voices and interesting stories and sharing them with the world.
My thanks to author, publisher, and founding editor of Press 53, Mr. Kevin Morgan. You can get lost with Press 53's 100th publication. It's a wonderful new collection of short stories by author Ray Morrison titled In a World of Small Truths. You'll find links to more information at wfdd.org/triadart. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Mr. Ben Taylor was in town last week with his band, and they were kind enough to swing by the station for a little live in Studio A action. They sound great, and that's coming up in the second half of the show. But next, we're off to India with the Sika Curator of Contemporary Art at the helm. The Southeastern Center for Contemporary Art presents Vibha Galhotra, Metropia, October 26th through February 10th. Indian artist Vibha Galhotra utilizes both abstract forms and images of the urban metropolis to address the radically shifting topography of India under the impact of globalization and growth. She sees herself as being part of the restructuring of culture, society, and geography of New Delhi and the world. So wrote Sika curator of contemporary art Stephen Maticio. He recently spoke with Vibha on the phone for the first time from the WFDD recording studio while I just looked on and smiled. By the way, one of Vibha's unusual materials is gungru. They're small metallic bells strung together to form a musical anklet that's tied to the feet of classical Indian dancers.
Every exhibition that I curate very much is a discovery. It's sort of a dialogue that happens in multiple pieces and multiple facets. And so when I'm first introduced to an artist, it's often through a book or a couple of images, and I continue to do detective work and find out more and more. And then as I do research, I'm sort of getting a more well-rounded picture of what that work is about and really what that artist is about. And so to have that dialogue with her through this radio station, I learned more about her work and very much how she communicates and speaks and lives her work.
Take over.
Hi, yeah. Viva. We've met now with email, and now we're going to meet on the phone and soon in person. So thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, and thank you for having this opportunity to show my work.
You know, your work is referencing, I think, some of these historical, like the traditions of the tapestry and sort of the history painting.
I am very inspired from plants, nature, you know, seeds.
Hmm.
You know, I use a lot of material which are being inspired from the nature itself. Gunguru comes from a seed. Tribal used to use a seed for making a sound to scare the animals when they are moving in the forest land. So from there, the evolved comes into metal and becomes gunguru, and that becomes the use of, you know, dancers for making sound in their dance to make it more lyrical. But in my work, I try to contradict with this material so that there is a point of dialogue that why I'm using this, because there is a kind of organic growth I'm feeling happening all around the world, which is unseen right now because, you know, the kind of greed we are going through on the name of development, you know, we are really greedy and we are just making concrete land all over around, and there is a different kind of growth happening underneath. Everything is changing for the new constructions by deconstructing the already constructed ones.
So, Viva, I wanted to pick up a little bit on the gunguru is obviously a very prominent element in this new body of work. And I read that when you were speaking about it as this seed that is sort of sowing new fields and hopefully pointing towards a new sort of form of understanding of what industrialization and urbanization is doing to the climate and to nature. And I know that you don't necessarily forefront it, but there are those elements of, like you say, the gunguru is often worn by Indian classical dancers as well as women across Indian society. And I just hope that you could talk a little bit more about sort of those feminist elements of your work, because I think there are there that you're a strong woman sort of establishing a strong politicized voice. And yet it never feels like you're didactic with that or heavy handed with it. So I just wonder how it factors into your practice.
Yeah, the gunguru is a very actually new addition in my practice. Earlier, you know, I have used a lot of materials and mediums. So I wanted to use some kind of material which is made by hand and it's very organic. So I found this material, but then I started looking at the other elements of this material, which is very women-centric and which is very feminist because, you know, we use it for sound. But in my work, you can't hear the sound. So there are a lot of contradiction I'm trying to talk about and, you know, irritation level that's covering this material with the other surface changes the whole appearance of that object itself. So I wanted to give a kind of dialogue to the viewer. There is a kind of suffocation in the situation and in the world. So with the feminist thing, I never thought that I am a feminist. And I never take that position because I don't think so, because I am from a liberated, very liberated family and very liberated situations around me. So I never got into those kind of situations where I feel being women, I am being suppressed or something. So in that case, I don't call myself feminist. But yes, being a woman, yes, I like to use very women object or women, you know, oriented materials.
I want to pick up on a little bit about the reapplication of materials and sort of and the cyclical nature of the sort of the life, death and rebirth of material, because it factors into your work when we look at something like the dead monster and sort of this flayed skin, the earth mover, the bulldozer sort of withering away and decaying. And yet you're also giving birth through the veils, I think, particularly the very abstract ones. It's almost this new form of map making where we're not entirely sure of the beginning and the destination, but you see something coming slowly into focus. And so I just wondered if you could talk a little bit more about sort of the mapping and that cyclical nature from sort of the decaying bulldozer into a new form of understanding the environment.
Actually, I started making this body of work with the series of veils. abstract formation on the basically 2D surface. And the reason for doing that was how the world is going to change and how the media scare people about apocalypse or the doomsday. From last 2 years, we are happening a lot of things about the doomsday. And I like to read a lot of things about the future. It has given me a thought, okay, if this doomsday or anything happens like this and going through the Mayan calendar or Nostradamus and then going through the readings of NASA, what NASA says that, yeah, there will be a change in the tectonic plate and the world is going to change. But in the last 2 years or 3 years, the observation with the economical collapse, from there I started weaving the new mappings, which has no boundaries, covering the previous constructed world, and it is going to be veiling the whole world again with the new mapping. Because I work around the issues of environment and the changing geographical situation of the city, Delhi, or any developing city in the world. So that's how this work has started evolving and shaping up. I work in a series. So the dead monster has started evolving when I started seeing these new monsters, you know, the bulldozers or earth movers moving rapidly in our surroundings, like new aliens walking around. There were new constructions happening, and there was a rapid change, which I think people were not able to cope up with. That was my observation. Okay, this is a kind of living animal living with us and deconstructing the whole environment around us. And I made this new monster, a new constructed replica of the earth mover, and started putting Ghungru as a new surface on top of it, as there's a new organic growth happening on this material, which is going to decay after a point. Technology also can be taken as a new shamanism and taken as a spiritual lead. And that's how the dead monster story goes on.
Sometimes when we think about environmentally conscious art, sometimes it can be hand-wringing and sort of this guilty, somber quality to it of how much we're losing. And while there is that, yeah, that sense of lament in your work, there's also this playfulness. There's this dreamlike quality, this utopian sort of visionary idea, like you're saying, like sort of that those seeds, the algae growing upon the ruins or the skeleton of an old monster, that idea of the playfulness, the sort of the shimmering quality, something coming into focus with your new work.
Me being from a developing country, everybody is so concerned. Every third person you'll meet, they will talk about the changing environment and the health conditions of people. This is becoming a big fear in the society, but we need to take it lightly somewhere. And me being an artist, I feel that visual art can create a dialogue, but it cannot change the situation. Things can be seen positively also, rather than just talk negative and talk about the solution rather than, you know, just blaming each other. So that's what I'm trying to do with my playfulness. I am not a very extrovert person in that kind of expression in public about my feelings. But in my work, it comes from within that I want to club everything. And then there is obviously a desperation to understand where I'm going and what I'm doing and where is the whole world going and what is going to happen the next. So that's what I try to concentrate with all these changes and this new economical zone. So there is a new hope which I'm trying to create.
Southeastern Center for Contemporary Art, curator of contemporary art, Stephen Maticio. Viva Galhotra, Natropia, will be shown at SICA through February 10th, 2013. The opening reception is tonight from 6 to 9, and you'll find links to more information at wfdd.org/triadarts. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and after the short break, it's art and music with Ben Taylor, live in Studio A. He's got a smoking new album out. It's called Listening, and I hope you'll stay and listen with us. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Romary Bearden, A Black Odyssey, is a truly dazzling exhibition of collages and other works inspired by Homer's classical epics. The tale of the traveler's search for home was a theme that resonated deeply with Bearden. He was a Charlotte native whose family was part of the great migration of African Americans to the North. This powerful exhibition expands our view of the Bearden canon and his influence as an artist, while reinforcing Homer's continuing relevance as a poet. A Black Odyssey is curated by Zora Neale Hurston Professor of English and Comparative Literature at Columbia University, Mr. Robert G. O'Mealy. Rinola House is the first stop on the Smithsonian Institution's traveling exhibition service, and the exhibition includes over 50 rarely exhibited works on the theme of the Black Odyssey. The beautiful and powerful works featured in the exhibition create a gripping narrative that's accessible and complex, timeless and modern. Robert O'Mealy, who is writing the catalog essay and interpretive material for the Sites exhibition, sees Bearden's Black Odyssey cycle as a metaphor for the American experience. He was a friend of Bearden's, and he spoke with me by phone from his studio in New York.
Bearden would cut out pictures of people that he found interesting. If he saw a woman whose posture fascinated him, something about a man's eyes or hat or gesture would appeal to him, and so he would cut that out and just put it aside. He had folders and bags of the way that great designers will have swatches of cloth and something about the color that they may be able to come back to later. And so he tells the story of a group called Spiral, black artists, Harlem-based, who were asking themselves how they could work as artists to participate in a positive way in the civil rights movement of the early 1960s, so it's 63, 64. And Bearden says he brought one of his folders of magazine cuttings to one of the meetings, and he said, hey, let's everybody come to the next meeting. You all have cuttings like this. Bring yours, and we'll all work on a collage and make a social statement. But the other people in the group, Norman Lewis and Emma Amos, as great as they were, just didn't want to do that. But Bearden said he was hooked. 1963, 1964, that he commits himself to the style that we think of as Bearden style. Bold colors, the jagged edges, that must be a Bearden.
How active was he in the civil rights movement at that time, around 63, 64?
Well, 63, 64, he responds to the civil rights movement, from what we can gather from the biographies, by saying, let's black artists stand shoulder to shoulder and create the images that we need going forward. It's almost as if he says, the artists are visionaries. Let's show people what things look like now, what the history has been, but also let's reveal what a future can look like as well. And so he's a member of not just Spiral, but of other federations of black artists, particularly Harlem-based, but not only there. Bearden said at that point he was encouraged again in this collage method, and he does what Ellington did. He practiced it and practiced it and worked on it and worked on it. Mood Indigo for small band, Mood Indigo for big band, Mood Indigo for singer. And eventually you've got a whole set of different ways to present yourself on canvas.
Bearden was strongly influenced by the music of Duke Ellington and other jazz and blues musicians. And in October of 1982, Bearden presented and spoke at the Rinalda House Museum of American Art in Winston-Salem. During the interview that followed that presentation, Bearden described why he was inspired by the blues.
The tradition in which I work out of, you might say, is the tradition of the blues. It deals with the complexities of life. For instance, Bessie Smith, the one of the blues singers, she's singing a song, you know, I woke up this morning.
When I woke up this morning, my sweet man couldn't be found. I'm going down to the river. Into it I'm going to jump. Can't keep from wearing all them down.
Well, she's singing about deep existential problems, she's bereft, her love life or the person that she's wants to be near, most is gone. But behind her, people are riffing, turning a very tragic situation into a farce. Now, the tradition of the blues teaches you how to survive.
I'm thinking of Bearden's then broadening the discussion, kind of moving this whole movement forward in terms of his later work in the 70s. And this is Romar Bearden's A Black Odyssey, the exhibit coming here to Rinalda House. Did he ever talk with you about this particular series of works and the connection with Homer's Odyssey, kind of broadening that the story of the Great Migration of African Americans, putting it in that framework?
Well, no, I attended that show in New York, 1977, but I didn't know him, really. I saw him, and later, as I say, I would see him quite often and get to spend time with him. I had a car, and so he would look for the kid with the car.
That's right. You're the man.
And I would drive Bearden and Al Murray around in 1979, 1980. But at the time of this show, he says, you know, this is our story. We're all black and white and Americans and non-Americans trying to find a sense of equilibrium in the world. Toni Morrison points out that there's no word home in French or in German or in the languages that she knew about. It's chez moi, à la maison, but you don't have home. House is not home, as we know from the song. So there's something peculiarly American about all that, but there's also something universal as we're all trying to find a sense of peace and equilibrium and stable values, places that we know and where we can feel at home. And so he tells us that he was interested in taking themes that we think of as belonging to the classical era or to some large universal world in outer space and showing that, yes, they do belong there, but they also belong to us. And we're searching for home, too. We're wondering where Daddy went after all these years. We're hoping Mama is going to be able to hold the household together. We're young sons and daughters trying to grow up. These are our stories as just citizens of the world. Elsewhere, he's asked about it, why did you make all the characters black? And he says, I wanted a black child from West Africa to look at one of these Odysseus collages and see herself or himself. I wanted to make the point that this is available to that spunky child who also sees herself as on her way somewhere, looking for home, trying to become as big as Odysseus was as a traveler through the world.
I think there are about a half dozen images from the exhibit on display online. Pick an image from the collection that has special meaning to you, Robert, and maybe we could describe it for listeners.
Well, yes, there's certain images from the Odysseus series by Bearden that are burned indelibly in my mind and that I just simply love. There's one called The Sea Nymph, which features an Odysseus now underwater after his ship has crashed. Poseidon, the sea god, has stirred the sea up so much that all the men on the ship have been lost. Odysseus himself is way underwater, and it looks as if he'll be lost too. But there's a goddess who looks like she's swimming in from the world of Matisse, if you can think of those female shapes in Matisse's cutout world, a black goddess swimming underwater. And she goes down and says, wrap yourself in this special wreath of cloth and come with me. And the idea that Homer had this vision of these women as leaders, as wives, as patient and wise and artistic, but also women as saviors, who plunges down in that water and brings my man on up. It has a storyline with it that resonates I think, with Americans, and perhaps especially with Black Americans, where so often the women have had to dive down deep and hold us together as a people.
My thanks to Zora Neale Hurston, Professor of English and Comparative Literature at Columbia University, Mr. Robert G. O'Mealy. You can hear Robert speak during Rinalda House's symposium, The Global Homer, Odyssey in the Context of Diaspora. Robert's the keynote speaker on Saturday, October 27th, and he'll begin at 1 o'clock with We Are All a Collage, Romery Bearden's Improvised Art. Rinalda House is the first stop on the Smithsonian Institution's traveling exhibition, Romery Bearden, A Black Odyssey, and it'll remain on display through January 13th. You'll find links to the complete lecture series surrounding the exhibition and more on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and it's time for yet another brief intermission. But this time, when we get back, we'll be live in Studio A with one of today's leading singer-songwriters, Mr. Ben Taylor, next when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. On Wednesday of this week, singer-songwriter Ben Taylor was in the Triad area for a special 90th birthday concert for his grandmother Trudy Taylor at the Arts Center in Carrboro. Ben and his band stopped by WFDD to jam in Studio A on their day off, and we'll get to that little recording session in just a minute. But Ben also recently released a new album titled Listening, and we're listening to it right now. This is Oh Brother.
Oh brother, won't you realize that you're a star?
Like most of his music, Listening covers a lot of musical ground, including pop, rock, and folk elements, as well as adult contemporary and country music. TheExaminer.com writes, quote, "It is safe to say that Ben's parents, acclaimed veteran musicians James Taylor and Carly Simon, are not the only talented ones in his family. Ben's singing and songwriting ability are also distinct and worthy of praise," end quote. Lofty praise indeed, but after spending an hour with Ben Taylor in the studio here, I'd say even that review was an understatement of his musical abilities. Factoring into my assessment is the fact that Ben played his guitar and sang like a fiend at WFDD, even though he walked into the station on crutches after recently tearing his Achilles heel, and he was nursing cracked ribs after a bad fall down a stairway the day before in which he re-tore his Achilles. After the recording session, he was off to the emergency room. All that to say, Ben was in a lot of pain and discomfort live in Studio A, but you'd never tell it by his performance. He stopped by WFDD with bandmates percussionist Mark Pusey on cajon, it's a box-shaped percussion instrument originally from Peru, and singer-songwriter and longtime collaborator David Saw on guitar. Sound engineer Ryan Casey set up the recording session taped live in Studio A.
They whispered softly.
Okay, well, you just play beat and I'll follow you. You ready?
I'm feeling hungry. Took everything from me. I looked up at the stars and asked them what the sun say. They whisper softly. It doesn't matter to you. It really doesn't matter to you. Now what the hell made the green grass grow? I spilled milk, I got to clean that flow. Monopoly trying to lean past go. Tell my brothers that I seen that bro. A traitor ain't what it seem as so. Nodding yes when they really mean no. The lifestyle ain't what the magazine show. We did it dirty, now we keep it clean. Low. I'm feeling hungry, took everything from me. I looked up at the stars, asked them what the sun say. They whisper softly, it really doesn't matter to you. It really doesn't matter to you. Auntie Pam down in New Orleans. She told me money never grew on trees. They printed a few twos, but passed on threes. So when the plague hit the planet, mass disease, I asked, who's on top and who's last to leave? Used to be only conservative, but master me. Now we all teach babies they have to read. Mama life feeds only who she has to feed. I'm feeling hungry, took everything from me. I looked up at the stars, asked them what the sun say. They whisper softly, it really doesn't matter to you. It really doesn't matter to you. Do believe, star, those pretty trees are expendable, pa, just like you are and what your needs are. It's 10 o'clock, ah. Do you know where your little seeds are? Welcome to the most pretentious show ever. And the nominees are those little things that matter to you. Those little things that matter to you. Ooh, I'm feeling hungry, took everything from me. I looked up at the stars, asked them what the sun say. They whisper softly, it really doesn't matter to you. It really doesn't matter to you. It doesn't matter to you. It really doesn't matter to you.
So that was a song called Hungry that I wrote with Bette Sussman and John Forte very many years ago. And we've been sort of kicking it around in one form or another, but it makes it to the show because we like to play it. I like to tell people that that the most pretentious show in the world are the little things that matter to them. Anyway, that doesn't seem very... That seems pretty mean-spirited. I don't think I'm that way. Anyway, this was a strange introduction. Now for something completely different. David Saul and I, we write a lot of songs together, and we were sitting in a flat in London that I used to live in watching Outkast videos on MTV. And it was the video for Hey Ya, I remember so clearly. It was Andre 3000 shaking his Polaroid picture, seeming so cool, telling the young lady in question that he would like to forego the whole formality of being introduced to her father and just have her instead get directly into his Cadillac. And I started getting jealous of it. I said to David, how come we can't write like a dead, honest, canine love song like that? And he said, because we can't get away with it. I said, well, how come? David's from England. That's why he sounded like that. He said, we can't get away with it, mate. And I said, well, why? And he said, because we're Triple S. I said, Triple S? What does that stand for? He said, sensitive singer-songwriters. I said, what, so we can't do Freaky? And he said, not at all. I said, well, what if we tried to write a song like Hey Ya, but in the style of Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young? And he said, what would your father say? I said, oh, I know what my father would say. My father would say, one, two, miss a few.
I just wanna take you out and get you drunk so I can have my wicked way with you. I'm just being honest cause I know the other guys are thinking just the same thing too. And I'm not gonna lie and say that I would take you out to dance. There's just no chance. Cause I don't even like the same music you do. I just wanna have my wicked get away with you. Don't you fight it. Don't knock it till you try it. Show me some skin, I might bite it. Ooh, I wanna have my wicked way with you. I don't wanna meet your friends or just pretend I like you. And I don't wanna talk about what happened on your favorite TV show. I just wanna get you close enough so I can take off all your clothes. And I'm not gonna make you cry or break your heart. Girl, we don't have the time. I'm
I'm just thinking of 3 hours or more so I can have my wicked way with you. Now, don't you fight it, because I think you're gonna like it. Show me some skin, I might bite it. Ooh, I wanna have my wicked way with you.
Wicked Way. We heard singer-songwriter David Saw on guitar and harmony vocals, percussionist Mark Pusey on cajon. That's a box-shaped percussion instrument originally from Peru that sounds amazingly at times almost like a complete drum set, and singer-songwriter Ben Taylor with crutches at his side and nursing a couple of cracked ribs. He sang lead vocal and played guitar for us live in Studio A. Be careful. Do what the doctor says. Take it easy. You already learned your lesson on that one, man. I'm sorry. All that to say, I mean, to be with a broken rib and a torn Achilles here in the studio and playing for us and playing that well, it's pretty incredible. Thank you for coming.
My pleasure, man. It's like I said, most of my songs are broken songs that sound better when I'm a little bit hurting.
It's like a friend of mine used to write songs and was really good at it. He used to put a pen between his fingers just to get a different configuration with his fingers to do something a little unusual and get some unusual sound.
Yeah, I throw the guitars into tunings that I don't know how to play and write on instruments that I don't know how to play. It's a lot of fun.
Get you out of a rut. Do you ever wind up finding yourself having to physically, mentally, whatever, get out of a compositional rut where you put some aside and try something new?
I don't, and this is perhaps a luxury that I can afford myself that not everybody can do. I tend to be prolific enough if I just wait until something is absolutely tearing itself out of me in a way which can only be expressed and articulated musically.
Huh.
I don't tend to sit down and write songs for the sake of writing songs. Or when I do, I'm never pleased with the outcome.
That book, Songwriters on Songwriting, something like that, Neil Young's approach, very different from Paul Simon, very different from so-and-so, so-and-so. It's such a personal expression, but you're actually waiting till it's just building up inside you, and then I got to get this down. It's not even a question; you got to do it.
Well, it's just there's 85,000 moments of potential moments of heavy inspiration during a day. If you were actually tuned into all of them, it would explode your brain. And it's just those things inspire you to do one thing or another. Maybe they inspire a non sequitorial tangent of thoughts, which leads you back to building a golf cart with your ex landlord or something, or maybe they lead you to something which says, "Wow, I have something to say about that." And maybe it's conversationally expressive. It's something you call your old man up and talk about. Or maybe it's a point you need to make to your lover because you haven't been communicating yourself right. Occasionally, one of those moments of inspiration, you hear it in your own head musically. You don't hear it as any other kind of communication. And when it's that, then that's the only way to express it.
Yeah.
I wait until that happens before I write a song because those are the only songs that really want me to help them write themselves.
It's great, revealing the statue within the boulder.
And those are the only songs that are actually willing to write me, too, and that's what I require from my art. I don't want to just be in control of changing it and the outcome of what my art sounds like. I want it to be responsible for changing me, too.
That's a great way of putting that. I never heard that before. That's awesome. Thanks. Hey, I wanted, Dave, could you jump in? David, I'm sorry.
Yes.
Could you all collaborate on, I mean, that's pretty personal stuff, and I'm wondering that process between the two of you, because on at least two or three of the songs on YouTube, you introduce them as a collaboration between both
David
of you.
David and I write tons of songs together.
How do you dive into that dynamic and then contribute and have your own personal expression within that?
I think it's because we're one person. We spend so much time together that I know what he's thinking, he knows what I'm thinking. We have similar tastes, and it just seems to work. I mean, it's a really, really effortless sometimes when the songs come.
We're like songwriting Voltron.
Yeah.
But the thing about it is going back to what I was just saying about inspiration, David's ideas, the ideas that he comes up with musically, they inspire me. So that's already setting me up for something which I've been inspired to have something to say about, and it's already had a musical beginning.
The melodic or harmonic component or lyrically as well?
Every way. There's no way of telling what is going to start a song. It's kind of like playing poker and needing jacks or better to open. You just sort of, we bounce ideas off each other all the time, and one of us will be like, whoa, wait a second, there's something in that.
Yeah, exactly.
And then it's really easier when you have somebody to write with. Not just anybody, but when you find somebody who's a good writing match for you, then It's like an effortless matrix ping pong game.
Well, that's what I want to ask you, because it is sometimes when you're clarity with somebody, it gives you that extra energy or confidence or whatever. But for you, David, what is that? What is that dynamic where it's the two of you that makes it? You're impervious to pain, or you're going to make the finish the tune versus just on your own.
I mean, I think like in some aspects where say like I brought an idea or a start of a tune, I don't think I would have been able to finish it without Ben, because he can take it to somewhere that I might not have gone, and vice versa. So it's a weird situation. We write songs in cars, we write songs at airports. I think the thing is like we both get so excited about it. That's what I love.
And it's going back to what you said at first about do we ever get stuck in a rut? And by yourself, it's much easier to get stuck in a place. Not a rut, but just you run out of what you have to say about on the topic, and you don't know exactly where else to go. And if you have somebody who thinks the same way as you but doesn't exactly have the same brain, then you bounce it off them and they say, oh, I completely know where to go from here. You know, David and I, it's like sharing the driving duty on a long road trip or something like that.
Yeah. And there's nothing better than someone going, that's great. Yeah. Because that gives you the enthusiasm to finish it.
Yeah.
You know, if you're on your own, you're always asking yourself, oh, is it as good as I think it is? I'm not sure, you know.
You and I don't have a whole lot of, what would you call it, pillow talk or sort of, we don't kid glove ourselves. No. We do not tell each other about liking stuff that we don't like.
Yeah, we're very honest, and especially when it comes to songs, it's like nope or yep, spot on.
And you need that. The dynamic between songwriters can sometimes be so mutually considerate and polite,
yeah,
to a detrimental level. You know, you can sometimes sort of and David and I have a pretty good back and forth about it, so
yeah.
it's good chemistry.
I'm always looking for parallels in Branford Marsalis, now lives in Durham area, and Joey Calderazzo, the pianist, used to play with Mike Brecker. They all are here, and they were just on the YouTube the other day talking about how they just improvising.
Mm.
It's a very similar dynamic. They were asking a similar question. Well, I just know him so well. I know where he's going to go with that phrase. I know what substitution he's going to use there. So when I come in, it's just, I know what's going to happen. I love that.
I think that when we met each other, there was a big David Saw-shaped hole in a lot of my music, and there was a big Ben Taylor-shaped hole in a lot of his music, and, you know, rather than try to fill those ourselves, we sort of try to make them bigger to give each other more space to be themselves and to make them truly collaborative like that.
Yeah. Well, just enjoyed listening to it. I mean, anytime you can jump into a new venue, completely new, foreign to you, makeshift setup and sound that good, it doesn't just happen overnight. You guys have both been doing this for a long time.
When we met each other, like the first, the day after I went to see Ben, and that night we went out and played 3 gigs, and like
none of which were booked.
None of them were booked. We just turned up at places and played, and we really started practicing. For the first 3 years, we practiced so much. I mean, we still practice a lot now, but like for the first 3 years was like when we were touring, all the other musicians were asleep, and we'd be in the back lounge just trying to hone down the harmony guitar parts and really
over and over and over again.
Yeah.
I mean, and I think as a matter of fact, it's come to a place now where at first we were a little bit apart from each other, and then we honed into sort of relatively perfect synchronicity. And now we've got this great thing where you push a little bit and I pull a little bit, and it creates the most subtle sort of subliminal tension, which makes the whole thing feel better.
Tempo-wise, push and pull? What do you mean by push and pull?
It's just it's not even a tempo thing. Our tempos are locked. It's just that his interpretation of the downbeat is ahead of mine. His one comes slightly before mine does. I mean, and I'm talking about ever so slightly. And my one is always confusing the hell out of drummers, because drummers are like, oh, wait a second, is this supposed to be slow, or is he just so laid back that he's about to phrase this next thing a beat late? And that's usually the case with me. I'm super back pocket, and David's right about in the middle, a little bit front pocket, and together we've got a loose chain, a lot of loose change rumbling around, and I'm making tens of dollars.
Well, that's settled into that groove. Second take of Hungry. You know, you're on just the very back end of the beat, and actually it was a little tempo shift as well, but it does make such a huge difference in the audience. There's a comfort level that we feel as listeners that
once you get the right pocket, everything's easy.
Victor Wooten said, you can't hold no groove if you ain't got no pocket. You know, I love that line.
He has such a deep pocket that he can actually hold a groove in spite of the fact that he plays every note there is to play.
Yeah.
And a half.
Right. Yeah. Great guitar work all the way around, too. I really enjoyed listening to your playing.
It's nice to be appreciated by pianists.
Well, I appreciate, in terms of just sound, I'm a huge sound guy. I studied the clarinet for years. This timbre just hits me. You've got, vocally, such a lush sound and so many of the best qualities that I just personally love in all my favorite vocalists. Did you just arrive there with those pipes, or have you developed certain aspects of your sound? I'm getting kind of weeny on you, but I'm,
that's a great question.
You talking to me?
Yeah.
I mean, I started out sounding almost exactly like James Taylor. And little by little, sort of different influences and whatnot, they sort of steer me away from whatever sort of genetic propensity to sound like that I had, and more in the direction of the things that I hear and like, and the person that I'm becoming.
Yeah.
I tend to think, like, this morning I show up to you with a broken rib and a snapped Achilles tendon and whatnot, and I've been singing straight for the past 30 days or something like that. My voice is spent now, and I think it sounds better this way than it does any other way. I don't have a lot of songs that are sort of shiny, happy people holding hands songs. Most of my songs, they got some broken element to them, and I feel I'm in a better position to be able to express those honestly when I'm a bit broken.
Yeah.
The one thing about Ben, since I've known him, is his singing is impeccable. His tuning, his pitch is absolutely, I mean, I've done countless numbers of shows, and it's just like, it freaks me out how it sounds so good all the time. It's like, damn it, drop a note.
I've dropped some notes, man.
Not many, dude.
You don't have enough of me in your monitor, man.
Yeah, that's just this morning, I'm reading this great quote from Thelonious Monk talking to Max Roach, saying, Max, would you just drop some notes already? Every gig. It's just too perfect, you know. Love it.
Thelonious had some great little sort of Bartlett moments, didn't he? Sort of, the other thing that he said that I love is, don't practice your mistakes.
Even in terms of projecting it within a really soft dynamic and getting that focus, I appreciate as a listener when you can hear that nuance. You just got one mic in front of you. There's no one here mixing. We're not raising the level to hear the crisp ending of notes and stuff like that. Is that something you've worked on, or how do you develop that ability?
I have an innate philosophy that's something that I only just learned to put words to because of something that one of my favorite poets said. But dynamic is so important in music because, as Mos Def said, true power move quiet through the understanding and the science. And it's really, really true. I'm in a position, so long as I have a captive audience, to be far, far more powerful with a whisper than I do with a scream. And that's just something that, in order to express myself the way that I want to and make the feeling come alive, I've needed to get good at being quiet.
Mm. Two thoughts come to mind. One was just last night I was in Chapel Hill listening to Michelle and Diego Cello. She was having some issues with her sound man. Jesse had a rough night, and she was with a smile and a softest voice saying, Jesse, we need to talk. But you could feel the hurt in the audience. Come on, man.
No, I would be so scared if I was him because she's such a beast.
You don't want to mess with Michelle.
Oh, man. Anyway. Oh, God.
Well, Ben, before I let you go, something about you that most people don't know about, even some of your most ardent fans, that you'd care to share. Not trying to put you on the spot, but I just went up and did it.
I've taken a great long while to become a more sensitive, patient, compassionate, imaginative lover. You know, really to the point where I don't mean to pat myself on the back about it, but I think that out of the ordinary.
Now. How about that?
Yeah, above par.
That's a setting example for the rest of us.
I think so.
Yeah,
you know? The sensitivity and imagination are really the two key components, I would say.
The phone's going to be ringing off the hook with some requests for Wicked here and there, but that's keeping it real. Well, thank you both so much for stopping by.
Thank you.
Sure appreciate it.
Pleasure is all ours. Thanks so much for having us.
America, how can we believe it after what we've been through? America, now we can't keep believing, but there's so much to do. So much to lose, ooh. She was as pretty as a dream, the most amazing girl I've ever seen. Not just did she look good, she made you free. She said you belong to me, and I won't see your spirit in shackles. The snake makes apple wine for the paradise fair, and Eden bats the lashes of her eyes, lets her hair down. The dancing feet so fine, don't wanna go nowhere, but she gets thirsty for apple wine. Sometimes, America, how can we believe it after what we've been through? America, now we can't keep believing, but there's so much to do. So much to lose. So then she...
Singer-songwriter and guitarist Ben Taylor. He was joined in our interview with guitarist and frequent collaborator David Saw. Percussionist Mark Pusey joined them live in Studio A on the Cajon. Our recording engineer live in Studio A was Ryan Casey. On Wednesday, they played a special 90th birthday concert for Ben's grandmother, Trudy Taylor, at the Arts Center in Carrboro. Their new CD is Listening, and it's available on iTunes, Amazon, and all the usual suspects. Well, that's all for today's show. Catherine Mobley produced the program. Our assistant producer was Natalie Barron, and our sound engineer is Eddie Garcia. You'll find podcasts of Triad Arts on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. And as always, you can send your questions and comments to triadarts@wfu.edu. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening, and we leave you now with Ben Taylor singing his patriotic tribute to our great nation. It's called America.
Old man Todd could never really treat her right. She cried and cried and tried to make him see the light. She only lied and always had to pick a fight. He spends most of his time abroad nowadays, so now she's mine. It's time to get her back on track. I've drawn the line and I'm not looking back, because it's long past time. Even if she's been through hell with scars and lies, she's still so fine, my America. Now how can we believe it after what we've been through? America. So much to do. Da 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 dum. Da 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 da. I know. Da 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 dum. Da 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 da. My Lord.